So right now is normally the part when I do the whole Star Wars theme, but Twitch has been being really crazy and YouTube's been being really crazy about using copyrighted music, so I feel a little nervous even humming the Star Wars theme. But anyway, welcome back to this. This is another episode of Socratic Citizen. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and it is Tuesday, January 5th, Election Day, the year of our Lord, 2021. You know, I was starting to get into a little bit of a rut there. And in my rut, I was starting to say that every day, like, oh my God, it's so depressing. Life is so hard. And all of our stories are just going to make you cry and pet your cats. So let's have like one story that's just not sad and hilarious. But I don't want to be that guy. I'm not that guy. That's not my thing. And so the universe, the world, God was kind enough to reward my decision to change my attitude with an actually, like, resoundingly cool day. So we've got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. I'm very excited for today. And the first thing that we're going to do is something I'd like to start doing all the time, actually. We were reading comments on YouTube, but I got this really good, really long comment yesterday from Eric Barnard. But YouTube has been doing this thing. And I don't know, I'm some kind of, like, Luddite. I do love my 1957 Tower Commander typewriter. In fact, more than I love my computer or my smartphone, which I suspect might actually be evil. But anyway, so I'm not a big technology guy, and so the inner workings of YouTube remain very often mysterious to me, and I still haven't figured out why I can see these comments in my alerts, but I can't actually read the whole thing. I can only read the little excerpt. So Eric Barnard left a great comment yesterday, I assume, because he said, here's my take. And normally when he says that, that means that here come 10 paragraphs of analysis. It was something about yesterday we talked about that new representative lady who was trying to carry her pistol around the Capitol. And so as exciting as that is, unfortunately, I can't tell you about it. But I do want to talk about some stuff that I found on Twitter, because as we know, the Trump era is coming to an end and Trump is fading away. Some would say into irrelevance. Some would say that he's about to, you know, start fighting the good fight from the outside. Some of us, like your angry uncle at Thanksgiving, are still convinced that he's going to be the president on January 20th. And I just, you know, want to take that uncle out on the back deck and be like, look, man, you're making everybody nervous, okay? You do realize that reality is reality, and Trump is not going to serve a second term, regardless of what happens in Congress tomorrow. And something interesting is sure to happen in Congress tomorrow. It's not happening. It's done. It's a done deal. Whatever you think happened, whatever you've read, whatever the Epoch Times and RT are reporting about, oh my God, stunning revelations, it's over with. So let's have some fun and look at some stuff from Twitter. So this, I think, is hilarious. Sebastian Gorka is a wonderfully entertaining, strong conservative, and he suggests that there should be a Fort Trump. But, and you know what? I think that might be kind of cool. I mean, it's got a good sound to it, Fort Trump. You know, Trump means to win. A Trump card is a card that wins. It's a card that beats all the other ones. He trumps you. You've been trumped, you know. So the U.S. military goes to a foreign country where our superior forces and technology trump those of our enemies. So that seems appropriate. But of course, the internet just can't let a Trump thing go without suggesting that Fort Trump, for example, be made of pillows. And perhaps the MyPillow guy, that big conservative guy who makes pillows, which, not what you'd expect a conservative to be doing for a living. You know, I expect conservatives to be running construction companies and defense contractors, not pillow companies. But hey, to each his own, I suppose. Amen. And a women. And of course, then there's, you know, Trump Tower, the guard tower in the prison where everyone thinks that Trump will end up, which is an interesting discussion in and of itself, because I don't think Trump's going to end up in prison. I think that once you get to the point where you're the president, there's a little bit of immunity there. I mean, good or bad, right or wrong, I think that is the way this republic works. And I don't think that we're willing to trample on that particular constitutional norm, because I think every buddy who would actually pursue that has an eye on their own power in the future. And they recognize that if we prosecute Trump, that opens the door to prosecuting presidents, and it opens the door to prosecuting other people, governors and senators. And so I think you really have to be pretty egregious to get prosecuted after you leave office. It's one thing to be like impeached and removed, but even when we impeached and removed a president, Richard Nixon, or at least pressured him into resigning, the first thing the next guy did was pardon him. So I would not be surprised at all if this whole like Trump is going to prison thing goes nowhere. And I mean, for me personally, I don't really think he did anything prison worthy. I don't think he did anything much worse than Obama or Bush or Clinton did. It's all kind of the same thing, but that's neither here nor there, because I want to move into some of those hilarious stories that don't really mean anything, but are still fun to talk about. And in this case, Kamala Harris is at it again. I look forward to 2 to 4 years of very entertaining content from Vice President Harris. I say 2 years because after that, who knows, she could be President Harris. We'll have to see what happens. In this case, she tells this story. This is the Daily Caller reporting. Kamala Harris tells a childhood story about calling for freedom is almost identical to a story by MLK. Maybe I should reread that, because that wasn't supposed to sound like I was an idiot. It was supposed to sound like I'm a child. So she wasn't calling for freedom. She was calling for freedom. All right, so let's read the piece here. So Vice President-elect Kamala Harris recalled a story from her childhood during an October interview with Elle magazine that is almost identical to a story Martin Luther King Jr. told back in 1965. So here's the two stories. So she said Harris was attending a civil rights march in Oakland, California as a very young girl, and seated in a stroller, she said that she fell out at one point, unbeknownst to the adults caught up in the protest. By the time they noticed little Kamala was gone and doubled back, she was understandably upset. The article reads, "My mother tells the story about how I'm fussing, and she's like, baby, what do you want? What do you need? And I just looked at her and I said, freedom." I don't know why she's a child with this weird lisp who can't pronounce the letter R. I don't know that young children, is that a thing with young? I don't have any children, so I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't know. I don't recall children sounding like that. But listen to the Martin Luther King story, and it actually makes more sense. So she tells the story in her book, in both of her books, actually. But here's the MLK story. And MLK was interviewing in Playboy, back when Playboy was something else, clearly. Then again, the rise of internet porn kind of destroyed Playboy. But I guess once upon a time, civil rights leaders were doing interviews with Playboy. I feel like the Trumpiest possible thing would be to give all his good interviews to Playboy, if only it was still a real magazine. So during the interview, MLK recalled a moment where a young black girl was accosted by a white policeman during a demonstration. And Barry Weiss is pointing out the similarity here. You'll all remember Barry Weiss, notably pushed out of the New York Times for being too radical, not radical enough. She was on the wrong part of the radicalicity spectrum, and then she notably appeared on Joe Rogan, and there's now that video floating down. New York Times journalist melts down on Joe Rogan. But MLK said that the girl looked the policeman in the eye and told him she wanted freedom. That sounds more like a little kid to me, rather than freedom. Freedom sounds like a Muppet, not a child. So MLK said, "I will never forget a moment in Birmingham when a white policeman accosted a little Negro girl, 7 or 8 years old, who was walking in a demonstration with her mother," MLK recalled during the interview. And yes, I'm assuming that he just talks in his preacher voice all the time. "What do you want?" the policeman asked her gruffly, and the little girl looked him straight in the eye and answered, "Freedom." "She couldn't even pronounce it, but she knew," MLK continued. "It was beautiful. Many times when I have been in sorely trying situations, the memory of that little one has come into my mind and has buoyed me." Anyway, I'll stop subjecting you to my MLK imitation. I'm sure that we're all tired of that. And so Harris's communications, the article ends, did not respond, or their communications team did not respond to a request for comment from the Daily Caller by press time. So anyway, I want to get to the really good news, and the really good news has to do with Julian Assange, my favorite journalist. So let's play the right intro animation here. There we go. So a British court rejects a U.S. extradition request for WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, saying he is at risk of suicide. So this is surprising for many reasons. First of all, this judge who prevented Assange from getting extradited, though I should note he's not out of the woods yet, but this judge has a pretty serious record. This judge has approved 96% of extradition requests. So the idea that she would approve any extradition or fail to approve any extradition request was really not likely. And then add to that the fact that it's Julian Assange, of all people, the one that the U.S. government really wants. They really want this guy. You saw what they did with Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning was seriously put through her paces. At the time, I think her name was Bradley Manning. But, you know, she underwent some kind of transformation in prison. Well, some kind of transformation. She went from Bradley Manning to Chelsea Manning. But yeah, I mean, of all the people who've done that, I would have to say Chelsea Manning is my favorite. For, you know, she helped with WikiLeaks with finding those documents. And actually, that's one of the big reasons why they prosecute Assange and say that Assange is actually not really a journalist. He is a hacker. And, you know, that changes things. So let's take a look at this article from the Washington Post, not a paper that I often have occasion to read, but they do a good job of summing this up. So let's take a look at it. So British court rejects U.S. extradition request for WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, saying he is at risk of suicide. So a spokesman for the Justice Department said the U.S. government will appeal the judge's ruling. Prosecutors want Assange flown to Northern Virginia to face the charges, which could lead to a life sentence in a maximum security prison if he were convicted. And let's just be clear about what maximum security means. In this case, these supermax prisons are lockdown prisons. In other words, prisoners are in lockdown 23 hours a day with virtually no human contact at all. And this has been pitched as this is torture. This is a form of psychological torture. And never forget Thomas Paine, who wrote in Common Sense that when the king, or more broadly, the government, when the king or the government gets called out or forced to reform their ways, they do not become more just, they only become more subtle. And so as just outright torturing people became a little bit of a faux pas, at least torturing American citizens on American soil by the American government, they had to switch not to more just methods of punishment, but more subtle ones. And so instead of tying people to racks and electrocuting them with car batteries, we now just lock them away for 24 hours a day with no human contact, which has all the same ultimate psychological effects. And Assange has, for almost a year now, been in something similar in the Belmarsh prison in England. And notably, his mental health has deteriorated significantly. And that is indeed the justification for not extraditing him. Those Nerdy Metal guys says, does this mean Assange only wants freedom? I suppose. Yes, that is true. I would, however, ascribe a little bit more authenticity to Assange's desires than Kamala's, because personally, I don't think Kamala wants freedom. I think maybe even at that young age, the real thing she might have said would be power, position, social cachet. But kids definitely can't pronounce those words. Power, you know, who knows? But anyway, so British judge Vanessa Bereitzer did not object to the merits of the case, she rejected claims by Assange's legal team that the U.S. government was seeking to punish the 49-year-old Australian for his political opinions and that President Trump wanted his head on a pike. I should note this is not unique to President Trump, that Obama did the same thing, and I'm sure Bush would have done the same thing if he'd had any meaningful way to go after Assange. So the judge said she had no doubt Assange could have had a fair trial with an impartial jury in the United States, and she was not concerned his prosecution would upend protections for journalists and publishers. I have to agree with her there, because what's already happened to Assange, to me, is proof enough that protections for journalists and publishers have already been upended. They have already been taken away. That indeed, there have not really been serious legal protections for journalists since 1918 with the passage of the Sedition and Espionage Acts under Woodrow Wilson. Good old Woodrow Wilson, the scraping, grasping authoritarian, wants to remake the world in his own image president from World War One. So she said that in encouraging hackers to join the CIA, which is hilarious and a good idea, by the way, or break into government computers to give WikiLeaks material to publish, Assange had not acted as a traditional investigative journalist. But Reitzer blocked the whole high-profile extradition based on testimony from psychiatrists called by the defense who stressed that Assange was actively planning to kill himself if ordered to face trial in the United States. Now, there is a hilarious part to this. As much as it's not hilarious that Assange has been tortured, basically, psychologically tortured in prison, and that before that in the Ecuadorian embassy, and he faces some seriously barbaric treatment in a supermax prison in Eastern Virginia, where all of these security, departments of the United States are headquartered. And so everybody's tied in somehow with the FBI, CIA, NSA, so on and so forth. That's where all of these people live, is in like Alexandria, Fairfax County, Virginia. That's like their hotspot. That's their home territory, their lair, if you will. And they're not going to be fans of Julian Assange because he is like the sworn enemy of that particular class of people. So she said the defense had provided compelling evidence that Assange suffers from severe depression. He has written a will and sought absolution from a priest, and that a razor blade was found hidden in his cell at Belmarsh Prison. Now, we talked about all of this yesterday when we talked about this story, because Assange has really, I think, reached the conclusion, and this article doesn't bring it up, but on top of all of that stuff, he's also kept in like a cage in the courtroom. Like, normally that's only meant for people who are at risk of, like, attacking other people in the courtroom. But just everything about this trial really evinces the degree to which the government wants this guy bad. They really need to make an example out of this guy, because he's really seriously embarrassed the various governments whose he has exposed. And now, of course, I'm not going to deny these arguments here. Where are they? Yeah, here, encouraging people to join the CIA and break into government computers. No, that's not normally what journalists do, but it was so effective and worked so well that I would actually go so far as to say maybe that should be like added to what investigative journalists do, is get jobs at the CIA. Does anybody remember the story about Scientology when the IRS decided that maybe Scientology wasn't a real religion? And they were going to investigate Scientology for being a tax haven. And so I don't think it was L. Ron Hubbard. It was whoever the guy who came after him was, encouraged all of the low-level members of Scientology to go get jobs at the IRS. And then he just obstructed the IRS. And you know, if you're good, you can slow the IRS down and make things take years. We're going to talk about that in the context of Google and antitrust investigations here in a second. But that's basically what he did. He slowed the IRS down, and 4 years later, after you have this wave of Scientologists who apply for every job opening at the IRS was full of Scientologists, and guess what? The investigation went nowhere. So I'm thinking, you know, if you really want to reform something like the CIA, if you really want to reform, let's take it a little closer to home, your local police force, don't throw Molotov cocktails at them. Go get a job there in like mass. You and all of your friends go get jobs on the police force and do it right. Do it the way it's supposed to be done. Get a job on the police force and then, drumroll, be nice to black people. And that would be, that's like, you know, if you're one of the people who's hates the police, that's like a revolutionary act. But of course, it doesn't look cool if you play a video of you getting a job at a police force with like some revolutionary hip-hop drum beats underneath it. Throwing Molotov cocktails looks cool in videos with revolutionary hip-hop beats behind it. So generally, humans confusing the image for the reality go for the Molotov cocktail instead of the hard work of real change. And this, frankly, to my way of thinking, is what the hard work of change really looks like. So I wanted to look at a few opinion pieces regarding Assange. Now, both of these come from RT, and I can sense some people wanting to wax critical and say, oh, yeah, Julian Assange is just a Russian asset. Of course, RT loves him, but Slavoj Žižek, this guy's name is a serious tongue twister for me. But this guy is definitely not a Russian asset. He is one of the foremost Marxist philosophers of the 21st century. And if you are good at reading, like really good at reading, if you get an A+ in reading, then definitely go pick up his book, Like a Thief in Broad Daylight. Its analysis of the 21st century world in Marxist terms is the best explication of Marxist ideas that I have read. And at no point does he become like, does he ignore facts or does he engage in simplistic thinking? He is a very sophisticated thinker. Notably, and I have yet to actually successfully watch this because this guy's voice drives me, he has the worst voice of any human being. It sounds like he's spitting into your ear when he talks. So I can only read him. But apparently he had a great debate against Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson representing, you know, Western liberalism. And then Slavoj Žižek representing the kind of Marxist futurist or would-be Marxist futurist side. So anyway, Julian Assange, this is an article that he wrote in RT about Julian Assange, and he says Julian Assange has had his rights stripped away in a case that should alarm millions, but too few people care because his character has been assassinated. And that is a very big point. They've had like 10 years to go after this guy's character, and so you hear all these stories. And actually, he'll go into the stories. I don't need to tell him right now. So he might have to go to prison before he gets the support he deserves. There was an old joke from the time of World War I about an exchange of telegrams between the German army headquarters and the Austrian-Hungarian HQ. From Berlin to Vienna, the message is, quote, "The situation on our part of the front is serious, but not catastrophic." And the reply from Vienna is, "With us, the situation is catastrophic, but not serious." I have to say, not a very funny joke. He's a better philosopher than comedian. So, he's going to do something with this, so let's just, you know, bear with him here for a second. So the reply from Vienna seems to offer a model for how we react to crises today, from the COVID-19 pandemic to forest fires on the west coast of the U.S. and elsewhere. Yeah, we know a catastrophe is pending, media warn us all the time, but somehow we're just not ready to take the situation seriously. There is a similar case that has been dragging on for years, the fate of Julian Assange. It's a legal and moral catastrophe. Just consider how he's being treated in prison, unable to see his children and their mother, unable to communicate regularly with his lawyers, a victim of psychological torture so that his survival itself is under threat. They are killing him softly, as the song goes. Again, not a very funny joke. But few seem to take his situation seriously, with an awareness that our own fate is at stake in his case. This is why this is important. This is why it's important that we think of Julian Assange like the end of Spartacus. I am Julian Assange. You are Julian Assange. If you are working somewhere and you see somebody from a government agency do something horrifying and you decide to talk about it, you become Julian Assange. If you are a cop on a police force and you see something going on you don't like and you want to do something about it and everybody turns on you and you're the problem for being the whistleblower, you are Julian Assange. And we can talk about the little sins. Everybody's got some little sins. Everybody's done things wrong. So you can sit here and go, well, what about this and what about that? And Julian Assange did this and he was mean to his cat or whatever. That is a real accusation, by the way, that he mistreated his cat. I don't really know the details, and I'm inclined to be suspicious of those details for the reasons I'm going through right now. The point being that what he did was seriously embarrass the most powerful governments in the world. And that is something that we who believe in freedom and democracy and the liberal values that undergird the United States and European societies, Western liberalism, as people like to say, that tradition requires that we remain in a constant low-level state of enmity with our government, that we are constantly checking and holding accountable the people who wield power, because we, like Lord Acton, recognize that power corrupts, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And so while there might be good people in government, I should have quoted Acton properly, power tends to corrupt. While there might be good people in government, the fact of a collection of power itself, any nexus of power, will attract to it the worst kind of power-hungry people. And those people will always infest the halls of power. And so it's up to people like you and me to hold them accountable. And it's up to, and people like Julian Assange, who have had a special set of talents, was specially positioned to be able to do huge things. You know, you and I are probably never going to do anything like what Julian Assange did because we're not hackers, it's not the right time and place, so on and so forth. He had an opportunity, a unique opportunity, to check the power of governments worldwide, and he took it. And as a result, they got very mad at him. And so it's our responsibility to kind of be on his side a little bit, even if we don't agree with everything that he did. Because what he did, the important part of what he did, is highly necessary. And if that doesn't happen a couple times every generation, we will lose the traditions that separate us as a free society from unfree societies like China. And that actually brings me to the next article I want to talk about. There's more to Slavoj Žižek, but this is important. So Charlie Nash here, also writing in RT, says only we can lock up journalists and get away with it. The UK embassy warns China. So this feeds directly into my point. The difference between our societies and Chinese society is not that we have McDonald's and they don't, because they do. The difference is that we're supposed to protect journalists who embarrass the government. We're supposed to protect people who check the power of, you know, the powerful. They don't have that in societies like China. And I've talked here on this show a few days ago, maybe a week ago, about Zhang Zhan, the Chinese journalist who documented the original coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, China, and how the Chinese government was struggling to control the coronavirus early on. She was just streaming from her phone, like real citizen journalist kind of stuff, and she's been sentenced to a prison term. And the UK, to go to the article, is railing against China's persecution of journalist Zhang Zhan. But back at home, Julian Assange is under lock and key at Belmarsh Prison for speaking the truth. The British Embassy in Beijing published a scathing statement against China for sentencing a citizen journalist to 4 years in prison on Monday, raising concerns about media freedom in that country. What it failed to mention, however, is that back home, the British government is currently persecuting its own journalist, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The case of Zhang Zhan, who was arrested for her reporting on COVID-19 in Wuhan earlier this year and today sentenced to 4 years, raises serious concerns about media freedom in China, declared the embassy, adding that Zhang is, quote, one of at least 47 journalists currently in detention in China. We urge China to release all those detained for their reporting, the embassy concluded, tagging its statement with the Twitter hashtag defend media freedom for one final level of irony. And so this represents really, the prosecution of Julian Assange represents a failure on the part of Western democracy, on the part of Western liberal societies. We should have known better. We should have been better. And indeed, I think one of the little pieces of good news that we can draw away from this is the fact that the president of Mexico, President Obrador, has promised that Julian Assange can live in Mexico if he wants. They will give him asylum in Mexico. And not only that, he has actually promised the foreign governments of the world that if Assange is given asylum in Mexico and left alone, that the Mexican government, quote, will not let him be active in the politics of any other country. So please just let this man live in peace. We promise he won't hurt anyone. So we wish all the best for Assange. Obviously, he's not out of prison yet because the American prosecutors are going to appeal the decision not to extradite him because they want to put him in prison for 175 years under the Espionage Act. So there will be an appeal, but this does mean that Assange can now seek bail. So we'll have to see what happens. In best case scenario, he could actually be out of prison in a week. He could actually see his family because somehow while locked at the Ecuadorian embassy, he managed to father two children. Maybe celebrity really is the aphrodisiac that everyone says it is. Otherwise, I can't imagine a man locked in a back room of the Ecuadorian embassy being, you know, a chick magnet. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about some of the other powerful people in the world and what they're up to. This is about Google. So Google, they used to have a motto, and that motto used to be, don't be evil. I don't know what happened to that, because lately it seems like Google really has embraced their inner evil. But there is a bright spot in all of this, and that is Google's employees. Normally, they're just agitating for some kind of weird facsimile of justice in the form of racial justice, but in this case, they've actually managed to do something that I think is pretty cool. And Google's workers, at least 200 of them, have announced in the New York Times that they are forming a union. So I guess that's what happens when you get a job at Google. You get huge amounts of money, great benefits, the chance to work at the most forward-thinking, powerful, and interesting company in the world. And when you have grievances against your employer, the New York Times opens its editorial pages to you. So let's take a listen to why this article is titled We're Google Workers and We're Forming a Union by Parul Krul and Chewy Shaw. And, of course, that's the first thing they bring up. Our company's motto used to be, don't be evil. An organized workforce will help us live up to it. So, Google employees... Let's see. Oh, I thought that was a caption. All right, so on November 1st, 2018, at 11:10 a.m., some 20,000 Google employees, along with employees of Waymo, Verily, and other Alphabet companies, stopped working and walked off the job in cities around the world. A week earlier, the New York Times reported that the company had paid tens of millions of dollars to two executives who had been accused of sexual misconduct toward our coworkers. Staying silent about the alleged abuse and letting them walk away with no consequences. Okay, so I have to say, it's to me, I don't know the inner workings of that story, but when I first started reading this, it was like, oh, they want to bring back the Me Too thing that mysteriously died when someone accused Joe Biden of sexual misconduct. But no, that's not what's going on here. So fear not. There's a lot more to this. People speaking at the protests that morning recounted their own experiences of harassment and discrimination at the company. In San Francisco, one woman held up a sign reading, I reported and he got promoted. Others read, happy to quit for $90 million, no sexual harassment required. And unfair workplaces create unfair platforms. We've had enough, these two employees say. The two of us are software engineers. That sentence should be, we two, T-W-O, are software engineers, because you wouldn't say us are software engineers. That's like saying me want ice cream. It doesn't make sense. But anyway, we were recently elected executive chair and vice chair of the Alphabet Workers Union, a group of more than 200 workers in the United States who believe our company's structure needs to change. For far too long, thousands of us at Google and other subsidiaries of Alphabet, Google's parent company, have had our workplace concerns dismissed by executives. Our bosses have collaborated with repressive governments around the world. We actually talked on this show about some instances of Google collaborating with the Chinese government to out certain Tibetan rebels, but I don't remember the details of that story, so I'm not going to go too deep back into it. They have developed artificial intelligence, to go back to the article, technology for use by the Department of Defense, and profited from ads by a hate group. I have no idea what they're talking about with this profited from the ads by a hate group. I hope they don't mean like Trump, because that really doesn't count as a hate group. They have failed to make the changes necessary to meaningfully address our retention issues with people of color. And I have to say, I don't really want to speak to whether or not Google has retention issues with people of color. I have no idea if that's going on or not. Really, this is about the relationship of Google to its employees and the response that Google has put out. So on that note, let's go from what the Google workers themselves said to what the Associated Press has to say about this. So a group of Google engineers and other workers announced Monday that they have formed a union, creating a rare foothold for the labor movement in the tech industry. Now, why would the labor movement have only a small foothold in the tech industry? What are these tech CEOs doing to keep the labor movement out of their companies? We shall find out. Let us continue reading. About 225 employees of Google and its parent company, Alphabet, are the first dues-paying members of the Alphabet Workers Union. They represent a fraction of Alphabet's workforce, far short of the threshold needed to get formal recognition as a collective bargaining group in the U.S. But the new union, which will be affiliated with the larger Communication Workers of America, says it will serve as a, quote, structure that ensures Google workers can actively push for real changes at the company. Its members say they want more of a voice, not just on wages, benefits, and protections against discrimination and harassment, but also broader ethical questions about how Google pursues its business ventures. So on the one hand, I'm happy to see Google saying, look, we're not going to develop artificial intelligence for the Pentagon, because that's scary and weird, and that's something out of like a horror movie, like artificially intelligent bombs. What is that? I don't want that, especially when they're going to use it on people like Julian Assange. But anyway, I am less excited, however, about the idea that they're using this to go after people accused of sexual assault, because I can pitch a reasonable version of this story that I think is what probably happened. You have people accusing, let's say, these two executives of sexual harassment or assault or whatever, and then they come to whoever and they tell their side of the story to the adjudicators or arbitrators or whatever the system is within Google. Google says there's really no way to ascertain who's right and who's wrong here. We're in a big mess. So I tell you what, we're just gonna move you guys elsewhere. Or go work somewhere else. Here's some money. We're sorry. We don't know, because you're operating on the one hand, these guys may have done something wrong, or I suppose they might be girls, but I mean, let's be real here. So these guys might have done something very wrong, so we can't have them at the company anymore, but we can't prove they did anything wrong. So we can't just like lynch them just because somebody said we should. You know, there's supposed to be some due process here. And by the way, due process just means some kind of trial. You can't You can't try 99% of people one way and then somebody else a different way. So if I came to the Google management and I said, oh, you know, so-and-so stole my lunch out of the fridge for 3 weeks in a row, and they go to him and he's like, "What? I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't steal anybody's lunch." And there's no way to prove who's right and who's wrong. Google doesn't just automatically side with the accuser. I don't think we want to live in a society where people just automatically side with the accuser. But for some reason, when it comes to sexual harassment, we assume that we just have to side with the accuser. When in doubt, throw them out. You know what I mean? And that's not good. Like, you can't really do that because that's not fair to people. Because all of a sudden, you've armed anyone who wants to cause harm to someone else. My boss yells at me, so I just accuse. I'm just like, oh, well, he tried to touch my butt. Like, that's, you don't want to create a society like that. It's not functional. You can't run a company like that. So, hey, maybe Google just loves sexual harassers and wants to let them, give them millions of dollars because that's their business model. Give millions of dollars to sexual harassers. I was not aware that was their business model. I would have to assume that they're somehow trying to act in a way that preserves their own interests, and they have an interest in not just firing anybody who gets accused of something, because then it's going to be really hard to get people to work there after a while. If every single time you do something an employee doesn't like, they just accuse you of sexual harassment and you're automatically fired. So I don't know. It worries me that that's what they're talking about. If you want, like, better wages, okay, great. If you want healthcare, okay, great. That's awesome. We haven't really arrived at yet the best way for adjudicating workplace sexual harassment claims, because it's very hard to gather evidence. And very often, different people have different perspectives on a situation that diverge so vastly that to ascertain who, if anyone, is engaged in actual wrongdoing verges on impossibility. It's just very difficult. And this has been something that has been all over the place. Whenever you try to go after sexual assault, sexual misconduct, whatever you want to call it, I guess sexual assault is a little different. Sexual harassment is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about, like, people raping their employees. That's a little different. That's something very else. But as long as we're talking about harassment, hostile workplace environment, so on and so forth, it's hard to prove it. It's hard to prove that it didn't happen. Like, heaven forbid somebody be falsely accused of such a thing, whether by a vindictive employee or simply because of a misunderstanding. Simply because I thought something was perfectly fine, you didn't. You go to my boss and say, this guy is sexually harassing me. All of a sudden, I'm fired and my reputation is destroyed. And I literally didn't do anything wrong, right? I'm not talking about people who pretend that they don't know they did anything wrong. I'm talking about people who genuinely get caught by surprise. I had no idea that was going to be a problem. So on and so forth. And we know there are people out there. We've been on Twitter. We've been on the internet. We know there are people out there who take offense to everything. There are people out there who are going to read everything as a form of sexual harassment or some kind of harassment. But the point here with this article, I really didn't mean to get off on that big of a tangent about the sexual harassment thing. This union has 225 employees in it, and Google has announced that they have no intention of negotiating with this union. They're not really going to recognize the union's existence, and instead, they're going to deal directly with their employees, as it says right here. As we've always done, we will engage directly with our employees. As this is from Kara Silverstein, who's a spokesperson for Google. So, and this is the interesting part, unionization campaigns haven't historically been able to gain much traction among elite tech workers who get hefty salaries and other perks like free food and shuttle rides to work. But workplace activism at Google and other big tech firms has grown in recent years as employees call for better handling of sexual harassment and discrimination and avoiding harmful uses of the products they're helping to build and sell. This is, I think, something that the CEOs of the big tech companies were very afraid of. They did not want this to happen. is we have to say that the employees of the big tech firms are among the most progressive, the most leftist group of people in the country. They make France and Sweden look tame. They make France and Sweden look like Brazil. So we'll see what happens and what happens when they, if they get any actual say in what constitutes avoiding harmful uses of the product they're helping to build and sell. So, I mean, of course, you know, if I was a true blue conservative or a... I keep saying true blue conservative. It doesn't make any sense. If I was a real red-blooded America conservative, I might say that Google's going to use that. Their employees will use that new leverage to try and deny Google services to conservatives and right-wingers. So we'll see what happens. And of course, there is, just as a quick side note, Google, by the way, has been dancing up to and sometimes over the line when it comes to being a monopoly. And, you know, the Justice Department's going after them. So I was going to do this article in a little more depth, but we're getting low on time here. And I've got another topic. But Google employees are free to speak up except on antitrust. And there's an interesting little tidbit in here where Google's compliance department will actually teach their employees that what they should do with any email that might be considered sensitive, any email that might look bad if regulators got a hold of it, is to put A/C, then PRIV, P-R-I-V, seeking advice in the subject line of any email they send on any topic that might be sensitive. AC PRIV, seeking advice or seeking counsel, means attorney-client privilege. And they're supposed to CC some attorney within the company. The idea being that if regulators ever came hunting, Google can refuse to turn over those emails to regulators claiming attorney-client privilege. This is a communication with our lawyers. This is us seeking legal counsel. Now, there's not a specific provision in the law in place for the abuse of attorney-client privilege. We all remember the scene from Breaking Bad, of course, where they have that, I think it's Mike, the, you know, the hulking kind of enforcer. He's going around to talk to various people in these high-security prisons, and he's bringing a lawyer with him. And they have the lawyer sit in the corner with his headphones in, while Mike talks to his guys, because as long as there's a lawyer in the room, there's attorney-client privilege and people can't listen, it's not admissible in court, so on and so forth. And this seems like a real-world version of that, basically. So Google's been desperately trying to avoid the antitrust thing. So we'll see what happens if the employees, instead of the legal department and the executives of the company, get control of Google, internal messaging at Google. We'll have to see what happens there. And of course, tomorrow is the big day, and I know what everyone's going to say. Yes, I am conscientiously ignoring the Georgia Senate race because A, I'm sick of hearing about it. You don't understand what it's like in this state. If you're not from Georgia, you cannot understand the absolute inundation of political ads that we have undergone here. This is like nothing I've ever seen in my life. It's nothing like the presidential election. The presidential election was a big deal, but this is huge. As we talked about yesterday, John Ossoff raised more money for this campaign than Al Gore raised to run for president in 2000. It's absolutely insane how much money and effort and time has gone into this election, and it's still not clear who's going to win. It's still a 50-50 shot who wins. But of course, with a 50-50 shot, that means that the likelihood is that Republicans will maintain their majority, because again, Republicans only need one win to hold on to a majority. Democrats need two wins to get to a tie, which Kamala Harris would then break in the Senate. So in all likelihood, Republicans are going to hold on to their seats because you've got two seats. Republicans only need one. Both of them are a 50-50 shot. So in like three out of four possible cases, the Republicans hold on to their majority. Either they win both or they win one. There's two cases. They either win the Ossoff race or they win the Warnock race. In both cases, they hold on to a majority. Only in the case of them losing both races do they not have a majority in Congress. But more interestingly, I think, is what's coming in Washington. Because as we all know, Trump is on his way out. He's fading away into irrelevance. And you can say that that's awesome, or you can say that it's horrible and you are crying because Trump is no more. But the one thing you should not do is think that Trump is going to be president on January 21st, 2021. He is not. He is a one-term president now. It's over. We can have fun with our friends partying in Washington and challenging the Electoral College count and making Mike Pence's life miserable. And okay, if you want to do that, that's fine. Have fun. But you're not going to change who the president is. Trump is not going to serve another 4 years. So anything that we do now as regards the Electoral College or the vote or investigating or whatever is symbolic, and it's a plan for the next election. If you want to create a commission to investigate election practices in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, then okay, let's do that. Let's spend 4 years investigating how they do elections and supposedly fixing how they do elections. But the Trump thing is over. The battle is lost. This is not the hill we want to die on, because it's not Thermopylae. This is not 300 Spartans giving their lives for the good of Sparta. This is dumb. This is a squirrel wandering into traffic. That's what this fight is. And so if you think that there's some symbolic value in you, the squirrel, wandering into traffic, then by all means do so. I have, however, the same message for people who think that Trump's phone call here deserves prosecution. But because Trump got on the phone with Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, and supposedly told him to, quote, find me 11,000 however many votes, that constitutes trying to commit election fraud and that Trump needs to be prosecuted. I have the same message for you as I have for Trump people who think Trump is going to be sworn in as the next president. No. Anything you do right now is symbolic. It's meaningless. This fight is dumb. And by the way, what he actually said was really not that bad. I mean, have we met Trump before? The guy's been president for 4 years. You know he says stuff like this. You know this is how he talks. And yet, for all the investigations that he's been through, for all he's had Democrats up his rear end for 4 years trying to find some way to get rid of him, so far he's survived all of it. And I think that that's because for all he talks a big game, he really doesn't do all the stuff that he says, that his bark is a lot more serious than his bite when it comes to stuff like this. But we'll read the accusation. This is from the liberals over at Raw Story. Top election law expert urges prosecution of Trump for, quote, shakedown call and, quote, belated ballot box stuffing demand. I think, first of all, more important than election law expert, we should know the partisan affiliation of this election law expert. Because as we saw, you had election experts on both sides claiming, first of all, that the election was the most secure ever. And then on the other side, you had election experts claiming that this was clearly fishy and statistically impossible. And it became completely impossible to navigate the competing demands of all the experts that had been lined up by both sides. And weirdly, each expert's expert opinion aligned bizarrely well with their partisan sympathies. So America's top election law expert is accusing the president of the United States of committing an impeachable and removable offense and of likely breaking both federal and state law in his now infamous Saturday shakedown call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California Irvine School of Law, that's quite a title, Rick Hasen, writing in Slate, says President Donald Trump, quote, certainly committed an impeachable offense that is grounds for removing him from the office he will be vacating in less than 3 weeks or disqualifying him from future elected office. His tumultuous term will end as it began, with questions as to the legality of conduct connected to manipulating American elections and a defense based squarely on the idea that Trump's mind is so warped that he actually believes the nonsense he spews. And then we have from The Hill, or no, that's not what I wanted to look at. Let's analyze a little bit here. I thought I had another story accusing Trump of evil doing. So the idea is that Trump was trying to convince this Brad Raffensperger fellow to just go find me some votes. Go print out some more ballots, because I know I lost the Georgia election, but I'd like you to change that. When, of course, those of us who have had our eyes open for the last 4 years knew that under no circumstances was Trump going to believe he lost the 2020 election. There was never any chance of Trump thinking he lost. That was never going to happen. Trump thinks that he won. He believes that he won. Many people believe with him that he won. In fact, a majority of the Republican Party, not the senators and House representatives, a majority of likely Republican voters in future elections believe that this election was stolen. And did I read somewhere that 30% of Democrats think the election was stolen? Like, okay, maybe this was the most secure election ever, as that Department of Homeland Security guy said, but it certainly doesn't seem like it. You certainly wouldn't know that from reading the news. You certainly wouldn't know that from surveying the American people. If this is not a crisis of election integrity, it's definitely a crisis of confidence in elections. And the fact that even Democrats think some fishy stuff went on, some Democrats, not a lot, not a ton of them, but some think some fishy stuff went down, to me is a sign that this things were not above board this election. I mean, I'm inclined to say that there's fraud every election, that that's just what elections do, is they just attract people who want to commit fraud. And all kinds of elections have tons of fraud in them, generally at a lower level, not like nationally coordinated. The lizard people come down in their spaceship from the planet Nibiru and direct the election. I mean, people at a local level are like, I really want so-and-so to win, so I'm going to like stuff the ballot boxes a little bit here because I'm the one in charge of investigating to make sure that no one stuffs the ballot boxes. So I'm the one who's supposed to get people in trouble. So no one's looking, no one's checking my work. So I'll do it. And I'm sure that happens all the time. I think in this election, it became a lot more important. And as a result, we're seeing people kind of finally opening their eyes to something that happens all the time. And you have a president who refuses to back down and refuses to just do the civil thing. And of course, that begs the question, why is the media going after this so heavily? Why are they trying to impeach a president who's 2.5 weeks out from leaving the office, or 2 weeks out at this point, from leaving? Why are you going to impeach Trump with 2 weeks left in his term? Just let him go. All right? Fat Daddy Sambo says, I've encountered several people on both sides of the fence that believe this election was rife with fraud. Not basement dwellers, but regular working types. This election deserves more review. I'm inclined to agree, Fat Daddy Sambo. But again, I'm inclined to agree that what we need is a commission to investigate the election. What we need is to spend the next 4 years. Hey, I got an idea. Let's take a page from Julian Assange's book. And if you're a Republican, go move to Philadelphia, move to Detroit, and get a job in their election system. Become a, not a poll watcher, become a vote counter. And we'll do what Julian Assange encouraged people to do with the CIA and what Scientology did with the IRS. Just go infiltrate the organization you're trying to reform. And then when they kick the poll workers out, you'll still be there counting votes, and you can call it out, and you can be the person who's the hero who saves democracy. But ultimately, trying to get Trump in for another term is not going to work. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. If you're listening to Lin Wood, you've lost your mind, because Lin Wood is a psychopath and a crazy person who thinks Jeffrey Epstein is alive. Just, oh my God. So, I have to say, though, Fat Daddy Sambo, you say this election was rife with fraud, not basement dwellers, and perhaps I am intentionally misinterpreting you, but I would say that this election was rife with basement dwellers, and in fact, that may be one of the problems that we face. The other problem that we face, before I close this out, because we are at the end of our hour, is I think that this whole thing with Trump's phone call is an example of this right here. So, for myopic media, and this is an opinion piece, breaking up with Trump will be hard to do. So we have Don Lemon and Rachel Maddow here, both looking kind of upset. You know, they don't want to give up their favorite drug, which is Trump. So this is a quote from CNN anchor Don Lemon. "Give us a while here in the news media because we've got to, you know, learn how to quit. It's like a breakup. We got to get the other president out of our phone contacts." I don't really get what that's supposed to mean. But breaking up is hard to do, as Neil Sedaka once explained. The ultimate test will occur on January 20th when Joe Biden becomes the nation's 46th president. Fat Daddy Sambo says, "No, the folks talking about the election being fraudulent are not basement dwellers, but average Joes. Average Joe Bidens." Okay, I'll stop making fun of you, Fat Daddy Sambo. I understand what you're actually saying. So if the apathy of actually scrutinizing the former vice president and asking something resembling a tough question during the campaign and transition are any indication, all things Trump will continue to blot out the sun. So we'll have to see whether the media really even continues to do what they've done for the last 4 years, which is kind of just ignore all other things in the hopes of just, we're going to get Trump, where it's kind of like the Joker from The Dark Knight when he says, you know, "I'm like a dog chasing a car. I wouldn't know what to do if I caught it." And I think the media is kind of like that with Trump. They finally got him. He's going to leave office, but they don't know what to do because they finally got what they wanted all this time, which was to get rid of Trump. And now he's going away and they're very confused. And their ratings are about to sink big time because nobody really wants to watch them fawn over Joe Biden. So that is that. That brings us to the end of our hour. I hope you found some interesting tidbits with which to annoy your friends of all political stripes by bringing up political and social topics at every possible turn of the conversation. If you haven't already, take the opportunity to follow us on Twitch, subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can, if you like listening to us in the car, find us on your favorite podcasting platform, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm on like 27 different platforms. So you can do that as well. Send us your comments. Our show archive is on YouTube if you want to go back and leave us comments, and we will read the most interesting ones on the show. And we will be back tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for another fun and information-filled hour of watching history unfold. So thank you all very much for watching. This has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.